The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
The man known to history as Woodrow Wilson was born Thomas Woodrow Wilson on the 28th of December, 1856, in Staunton, Virginia. His father was Joseph Ruggles Wilson, the son of a newspaper editor and member of the Ohio legislature. After studying at a seminary, Joseph became a professor of chemistry and natural sciences at Hampden Sidney College in Virginia, but in June 1855, he moved to Staunton, a town of fewer than 4,000 people, where he took over as head of the First Presbyterian Church. Like most of the town, the Wilsons were Scots-Irish Presbyterians. Woodrow's mother, Janet, was 19 years old when she married her husband Joseph in 1849. Known by her family as Jessie, she came from a family of Scottish churchmen and was born in Carlisle, England, before emigrating to Ohio with her family as a child. Following her marriage, she would have two daughters, Marion, born in 1851, and Anne, in 1853, before the birth of her third child and first son, Thomas Woodrow, in 1856. A second son, Joseph, would be born in 1867. In 1858, Joseph Wilson was invited to take over the ministry at the First Presbyterian Church in Augusta, Georgia, a town of 12,000 residents and a center for the lucrative cotton trade. Within a couple of years, the Republican candidate Abraham Lincoln was elected President of the United States. The Southern states, afraid that Lincoln would abolish slavery, decided to secede from the Union one by one, led by South Carolina on the 20th of December, 1860. On the 19th of January, 1861, Georgia became the fifth state to secede, forming part of the Confederate States of America when it was proclaimed on the 8th of February. Despite his Ohio upbringing, James Wilson rallied to the South, and in December 1862, the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in the Confederate States of America met at his church in Augusta, electing him permanent clerk. The Civil War does not appear to have had a major psychological impact on young Thomas Woodrow. Nicknamed Tommy, he enjoyed a happy childhood with two adoring elder sisters and was his mother's favorite child. He may have suffered from dyslexia, as he did not learn his alphabet until the age of 9 and could not read fluently until the age of 12, though he later received good grades in Latin, Greek, and French at college without acquiring fluency. In 1870, Joseph Wilson became professor at the prestigious Columbia Theological Seminary in South Carolina, but resigned 4 years later and moved the family again, this time to Wilmington, North Carolina. Tommy expressed a desire to enter politics from a young age. He continued to identify with the Southern states after the Civil War and joined the Democratic Party. The Democrats had dominated Southern politics before the war and opposed the abolition of slavery, but the Republicans had taken over control of the South in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War and enforced voting rights for the former slaves. By the 1870s, the Democrats began to use intimidation tactics against the local black population to prevent them from voting, enabling them to take back control of the South. With the Republicans in the federal government facing corruption scandals and an economic crisis, the Democrats faced little resistance in reimposing white supremacy across the southern states through the mechanisms of segregation and the Jim Crow laws from the 1870s onwards. In late 1873, Woodrow entered Davidson College in North Carolina, but after a year, he left and entered Princeton College in New Jersey as an 18-year-old in 1875. During his first 2 years, he did not find class particularly challenging, and instead spent most of his time reading, being particularly influenced by the Anglo-Irish statesman and father of liberal conservatism, Edmund Burke. He joined the Whig Debating Society and wrote for the campus newspaper, The Princetonian, becoming its managing editor in 1879. He took a special interest in British politics and government, which he considered superior to the American political system. Despite his upbringing, he soon abandoned the Southern doctrine of states' rights in favor of a strong, centralized national government and considered Alexander Hamilton the greatest of the founding fathers. Despite his desire to enter politics or become a political writer, following his graduation in the autumn of 1879, Woodrow Wilson bowed to family pressure by enrolling at the University of Virginia Law School. As at Princeton, he spent much of his time writing and debating and served as president of the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society. It was also at this time that he decided to drop his first name in favor of the alliterative Woodrow Wilson. In December 1880, he withdrew from the university after an illness and continued his legal studies at home in Wilmington. In 1882, Wilson established a law practice in Atlanta, Georgia. However, he had few clients and no real love for the law. Hence, Wilson only argued two or three cases at court before he decided to abandon his legal practice in the spring of 1883 for a career in academia, acquiring a position as a graduate student in the Faculty of History and Political Science at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Before leaving Atlanta, Wilson met Ellen Louise Axon, the daughter of a Presbyterian minister who was one of his father's friends. After first meeting in April, the pair met on several further occasions and became engaged in September. At Johns Hopkins, he began work on a book project about the American Constitution, inspired by the late English political scientist Walter Bagehot's study of the British Constitution. By September 1884, he completed the manuscript, which was accepted by publisher Houghton Mifflin and published under the title Congressional Government in January 1885. Although his book received critical acclaim, Wilson decided not to pursue a doctorate and instead accepted an offer to be an associate in history at Bryn Mawr College, the newly founded women's college in Pennsylvania. Before taking up his new position in September, Wilson and Ellen journeyed south and married on the 24th of June 1885 in Savannah, Georgia. Ellen joined her husband but returned south to give birth to her daughter Margaret in April 1886, followed by a second daughter named Jessie in August 1887. A third and final daughter, Eleanor, would be born in October 1889. While he was busy teaching 5 courses in history and political science each semester, Wilson changed his mind about the doctorate and passed his examinations at Johns Hopkins in May 1886. With his PhD, Wilson was promoted to associate professor at Bryn Mawr, but after a couple of years in the post, he became disillusioned with teaching women politics at a time when they did not have the right to vote in the US. In June 1888, he took up a full professorship at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. In 1889, he published The State, a textbook in which he set out ideas for how states govern societies, expressing sympathy for some socialist ideas. Wilson had always hoped for a teaching post at Princeton, and in February 1890 he achieved his goal when he became a professor in public law there, returning to Alma Mater in the fall term. He soon acquired a reputation as a popular and compelling lecturer. He also began to have ideas about the university's approach to education, proposing a greater emphasis on reading assignments for students. He hoped to set up an integrated law school within the university, which would offer students the ability to take courses in history, politics, and philosophy alongside their legal studies. Wilson continued to write during this period, producing a book, Division and Reunion, 1829 to 1889, in 1893, which surveyed the long descent into the American Civil War and the reconciliation afterwards. His interests in politics continued too, sharing a platform with Theodore Roosevelt at an anti-corruption meeting in Baltimore in 1896. The pair became friends for a time thereafter, even as Roosevelt's political star was in the ascendant, winning election as governor of New York in 1898 and vice president of the United States in 1900. When President William McKinley was assassinated in September 1901, Roosevelt succeeded him by default as President of the United States. In October 1896, Princeton celebrated its 150th anniversary. At the ceremony, Wilson was given the honor of delivering the keynote address before President Grover Cleveland and other attendees. This was a sign of Wilson's prestige, and in 1898, he was offered $6,000 a year to become president of the University of Virginia, an offer which he leveraged to negotiate a $2,500 increase in his salary at Princeton. In 1900, the magazine Harper's offered Wilson $12,000 for 12 installments of a history of the United States, which was subsequently published in 1901 and 1902 in five volumes as A History of the American People. Although it was far from his best work, the whole enterprise earned him over $40,000 and made him increasingly financially independent. Meanwhile, when Princeton's president, Francis Patton, decided to retire in 1902, he recommended that Wilson should be his successor, a proposal which was followed, and in October 1902, 46-year-old Woodrow Wilson was inaugurated as president of Princeton University in a ceremony attended by such luminaries as former President Grover Cleveland and the banker J.P. Morgan. Wilson also ensured the attendance of three female representatives from women's colleges and the African-American principal of Alabama's Tuskegee Institute, Booker T. Washington. Wilson's program to reform the university, which included a new law school and an engineering school, required significant funding beyond the $3.8 million in the university's coffers, and he had spent the summer of 1902 seeking out wealthy donors such as J.P. Morgan and Andrew Carnegie, though Wilson did not particularly enjoy begging for money. Before he could carry out his reforms in earnest, he had to assemble an experienced team around him, and in June 1903, he appointed as Dean of the faculty Harry Fine, a mathematician who had been a friend during his undergraduate days. find described Wilson's approach to leadership as one where he would make up his own mind about the larger policies, but to ask colleagues for advice with the details, an approach which would later cause him to lose the support of close friends in the faculty. Fine helped Wilson appoint promising scientists who helped to expand the faculty from 108 to 172 members during Wilson's presidency. He organized them into 11 departments and was himself head of history and politics, where he taught two courses a year and remained on friendly terms with the students. Wilson's hard work as a university reformer soon took its toll on his health, and in May 1906, he found that he was blind in the left eye. He was informed that it was caused by arteriosclerosis, a hardening of the arteries, and was advised to take 3 months off work, which he did, travelling to England to spend time recuperating in the Lake District. When he returned to Princeton, he presented what he termed the Quad Plan as a scheme for students and faculty to live together in self-contained residential units following the examples of Oxford and Cambridge in England, but it was resisted by students and alumni. In December, he was obliged to take another break, this time in Bermuda, after suffering from numbness in his right hand. During this first visit, he met Mary Peck, a socialite from Massachusetts long estranged from her husband, beginning a relationship which may have been sexual. By the time Wilson returned to Princeton in 1908, there was an ever-growing list of problems. Notably, his continued efforts to impose the Quad Plan and also deliberations over the financing of a new graduate school and where it would be built. His desire to hew his own path and not bend to the will of wealthy alumni who wanted too great a say in these decisions undermined Wilson's authority as president of Princeton and left him with many enemies among the faculty and trustees. By the end of the 1900s, he was seeking new pastures. During his presidency of Princeton, Wilson was so busy with academic politics that he had little time for the real thing, though he continued to think and write about it. In 1908, for instance, he published Constitutional Government in the United States, a book which expanded on the themes in Congressional Government by providing a more detailed examination of the presidency and the judiciary. He continued to be critical of Congress and advocated a stronger president who should be the undisputed leader of their party, in contrast to the existing American system, where the president's authority within his own party could be challenged by congressional leaders such as the Speaker of the House. On contemporary political issues, he began to move away from conservatism towards progressivism, deploring the fact that so much wealth in the country was concentrated in the hands of a select few. This was in line with contemporary politics, and this is usually referred to as the progressive era in American politics. During it, a succession of presidents like Wilson's old friend Teddy Roosevelt tried to introduce policies which would redistribute some of the enormous wealth which figures like John D. Rockefeller and Henry Clay Frick had acquired as part of the rapid industrialization of the United States in the second half of the 19th century. Their goal was to help the millions of poor working-class Americans and migrants who filled cities like New York, Philadelphia, Boston, Detroit, and Chicago in the 1890s and 1900s, living in sprawling tenements where people lived on subsistence wages and worked long hours at jobs where health and safety was often non-existent. In the midst of his woes at Princeton, Wilson was being courted by the magazine editor George Harvey, a standard bearer for the Democratic Party in New Jersey, to run for the office of state governor. Harvey was on good terms with former Senator James Smith and his son-in-law, James Nugent, who collectively ran the New Jersey Democratic Party machine. Although the Democrats had not won a gubernatorial election in the state for 15 years, the Republican Party was divided on economic issues in the state in the late 1900s, and Harvey and the Nugents believed that Wilson's profile as head of Princeton was such that he might be able to win back the governor's mansion for the Democrats if he stood for election. Already well into his 50s, Wilson realized that this was, maybe, his last opportunity to enter national politics, and he agreed, setting out his platform as a progressive in the autumn of 1910. During the campaign, he abandoned his professional tone to become an effective campaigner who was not afraid of asserting his progressive credentials, often in defiance of the Democratic Party machine. On the 8th of November, Wilson defeated Republican Vivian Lewis by a margin of 54% to 43% and became governor of New Jersey. Even before he was inaugurated as governor, Wilson was involved in fights with the party machine, favoring the progressive candidate Jim Martine to stand for the Democrats in the state senatorial election and appointing the progressive assemblyman Joseph Tumulty as his secretary. The new governor's bullish attitude towards the party machine gave Wilson national recognition, and progressive Democrats quickly began speaking of him as their potential presidential candidate in 1912. Although he had not given much thought to state politics in his political writings, Wilson approached the governorship in the same terms as the presidency, considering himself the elected official who was most closely connected to the voters and who had the right to appeal to the people over the state legislature. He was also capable of bipartisanship, reaching out to George Record, the leader of the Progressive Republicans in New Jersey. The two agreed on a common set of priorities, and over the next year, Wilson and Record worked closely on electoral reform, while Woodrow also focused on combating corruption, regulating the utility companies, and engaging in administrative and educational reforms. In the spring of 1911, Wilson met with William Jennings Bryan, a charismatic standard-bearer of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. It was part of growing conversations he was having in the early 1910s which led to the announcement of his candidacy to become the Democratic Party's nominee for the 1912 U.S. presidential election. He faced strong challenges for the Democratic nomination from Speaker of the House James Beecham, Clerk of Missouri, and the House Majority Leader Oscar Underwood of Alabama, whose support among conservative Southern Democrats reflected Wilson's weakness in that constituency. In the spring of 1912, Clark won several primaries in the west and northeast of the country, while Underwood performed strongly in the south, leaving Wilson with a handful of states, including New Jersey. When the Democratic National Convention met in Baltimore in June 1912, Wilson did not expect to win the nomination. Clark led Wilson in the first ballot by 440 votes to 324, and by the 10th ballot had won a majority of delegates. Yet, under party rules, the winning candidate required the support of two-thirds of the delegates. With his prospects hanging by a thread, Wilson's campaign managers made backroom deals which gradually shifted the numbers in the governor's favor. On the 2nd of July, Woodrow Wilson was chosen as the Democratic nominee for the president on the 46th ballot. Thomas R. Marshall, the popular governor of the swing state of Indiana, was chosen as the vice presidential candidate. The drama of the Democratic Convention of 1912 was nothing like that of the Republican one, which saw former President Theodore Roosevelt, the Republican president between 1901 and 1909, challenge his successor, William Howard Taft, who was still in office and was serving a term between 1909 and 1913. Although Taft had been Roosevelt's chosen successor to continue his progressive agenda, the former had proven a reluctant progressive who was more comfortable backing business interests. Though Roosevelt had won more delegates in the primaries, the party machine ensured that Taft secured the nomination, prompting Roosevelt to set up a new party, the Progressive Party, or the Bull Moose Party, as it was nicknamed. He would run through this as a third party candidate. In the presidential election that followed, Taft's unpopularity was such that only Wilson and Roosevelt had a realistic chance of winning. In the course of the election, Wilson attacked Roosevelt as a power-hungry egotist who was trying to breach the principle established by George Washington of not serving more than two terms as president, a rule which was not yet part of the Constitution in the early 20th century, although Roosevelt argued that his first term did not count, as he had not won election in 1901, but had succeeded to the office when President McKinley died. Despite the rancor of the campaign, when Roosevelt was wounded in an assassination attempt on the 14th of October, Wilson graciously suspended his campaign. His arguments against Roosevelt serving a third term worked. On election day, on the 5th of November 1912, Wilson won a landslide victory with 435 Electoral College votes to Roosevelt's 88. As he prepared to take office, Wilson sought advice on cabinet appointments from Colonel Edward House, a wealthy businessman who had been the power behind the throne in the Texas Democratic Party and would become one of Wilson's closest advisors as president. The president-elect offered William Jennings Bryan the State Department, while the Treasury went to William McAdoo, a New York railroad operator who had been instrumental in managing Wilson's presidential campaign. Wilson appointed James Clark McReynolds of Tennessee as Attorney General on House's recommendation. New Jersey lawyer Lindley Garrison was given the War Department, while the Navy went to the North Carolina journalist Joseph S. Daniels, whose assistant would be Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a distant cousin of Wilson's defeated rival who would become president himself in the 1930s. Following a principle he had employed at Princeton, Wilson would allow his cabinet secretaries the autonomy to manage their own departments while he focused on the bigger picture. On the 4th of March 1913, Woodrow Wilson was inaugurated as the 28th President of the United States, following one of the most rapid ascents in American political history. Just 5 years earlier, he had still been working at Princeton. Wilson had coined the slogan "New Freedom" to describe his ambitious domestic agenda, and in his inaugural address, he spoke of lowering tariff rates, introducing an income tax, banking reform, and natural conservation, the latter being a key part of Theodore Roosevelt's agenda as president. As part of his desire to speak to the people, Wilson became the first president to hold regular off-the-record press conferences in the White House. In order to promote his domestic reforms in Congress, on the 8th of April, Wilson became the first president to address a joint session of Congress in person for over a century, once again applying his theory of parliamentary leadership. Following consultation with congressional leaders, Wilson decided to start with tariff reform. Most Democrats were united in the desire to lower the tariff, which protected American manufacturing interests, predominantly in the North, at the expense of higher prices for consumers. In May, House Majority Leader Underwood produced a bill to reduce tariff rates by 10%, alongside a provision to levy an income tax of up to 4% in order to make up the lost revenue. The bill passed the House easily, and Wilson overcame Senate protectionists by threatening investigation of business lobbying, following which the Senate largely capitulated, though at a lower tariff rate. One of Wilson's most enduring legacies as president was achieved early on. When he came to the White House, the United States had no central bank. One of the founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton, had created the first national bank in 1791, but President James Madison allowed its charter to expire in 1811, and thereafter many states remained opposed to a federal bank. However, a financial crisis in 1907, known as the Panic of 1907, had reignited the debate about the need for federal oversight of the financial system. There were several competing proposals as to how this could be achieved, and no concrete progress had been made either during Roosevelt's second term or Taft's. The debates were not only about the desirability of a central bank, but also whether it should be in public or private hands. In June 1913, Wilson proposed a government-run Federal Reserve Bank, which would issue money through a network of 12 regional banks. Wilson was especially keen to ensure that no bankers would be appointed to the board. The Federal Reserve Bill passed the House by an overwhelming margin in September, but in the Senate, Wilson had to stand firm against a Republican attempt to dilute the goal of federal oversight. The Federal Reserve Act was passed in late December 1913 and created a government agency with its board appointed by the president, largely reflecting Wilson's initial proposals. Its importance has been firmly demonstrated in recent times in its central role in combating inflation in America in the early 2020s. The third major item on Wilson's domestic reform agenda was the regulation of monopolies. Both Roosevelt and Taft had used the Sherman Antitrust Act to break up large monopolies, but Wilson believed that the Sherman Act was not sufficient to promote competition. After the president presented his plans to Congress in January 1914, House Judiciary Committee Chairman Henry Clayton of Alabama prepared a bill to ban anti-competitive practices such as predatory pricing among large firms trading with each other, with further provisions to make executives and directors of companies violating antitrust laws liable for prosecution. Wilson also offered some concessions to union leaders, but did not agree to their demands for full exemption from antitrust laws. Although the Senate would strike out the section on criminal penalties, the Clayton Act was passed by Congress and signed into law in October. A few weeks earlier, the president had signed the Federal Trade Commission Act, creating a federal regulatory agency to investigate and take enforcement action against unfair trade practices. Before assuming the presidency, Wilson had paid little attention to foreign policy, but during his first term, political instability in Mexico proved a major distraction. In 1910, the Mexican Revolution had begun, following the long military dictatorship of Porfirio Diaz. One episode of this 10-year period of turbulence in Mexico saw General Victoriano Huerta overthrow the democratically elected government of Mexico in February 1913. While American business interests hoped the general might establish a stable government to protect their property rights, Wilson denounced the coup and refused to recognize Huerta's government. After exhausting diplomatic options to remove Huerta, Wilson took advantage of an incident involving the arrest of American sailors in a Mexican port in order to send a fleet to capture the port of Veracruz on the 21st of April 1914. The ensuing action resulted in the deaths of more than 150 Mexicans and 17 American servicemen. When both Huerta and his constitutionalist opponent, Venustiano Carranza, denounced the American intervention, Wilson backed down and agreed to mediation from Argentina, Brazil, and Chile. Despite the mixed results of intervention in Mexico, Wilson later authorized the American military occupation of the Dominican Republic and Haiti in an effort to establish political order and protect American interests in the Caribbean. Wilson's promising start to his presidency was blighted by family tragedy when his wife, Ellen, died of nephritis of the kidneys on the 6th of August 1914. The devastating blow for Woodrow came just as the First World War was breaking out in Europe, pitching the Entente powers of Britain, France, and Russia against the Central Powers of Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire. Wilson was keen to stay out of the war and proclaimed neutrality, but the increased demand for munitions from Europe created the conditions for an economic boom from late 1914. Although the British naval blockade of Germany affected American trade, the Wilson administration preferred to stay quiet. In December 1914, Republican Senator Henry Cabot Lodge and former President Roosevelt attacked the administration's neutrality policy by denouncing German atrocities in Belgium and argued that the United States was not ready to defend itself against German imperialism. Wilson responded by describing the conflict as a war with which we have nothing to do, and only approved modest increases in military spending. Although he was personally sympathetic towards the Allies and resisted attempts by pro-German lobbyists to stop the export of arms to the Allies as a violation of neutrality, Wilson was in tune with public opinion in his desire to avoid getting involved in what was viewed as a European war fought over European issues. Wilson's policy of neutrality was soon disturbed by unwise German actions. In February 1915, the German Navy began submarine attacks on all merchant shipping around the British Isles, including neutral vessels. Wilson responded by warning the German government that the United States would hold them to strict accountability if American ships were sank and American lives lost. Despite these warnings, issues quickly arose. On the 7th of May 1915, the British liner Lusitania was sunk by a German torpedo with a loss of 1,198 lives, including 128 Americans. While American public opinion was outraged, the country was still disinclined to go to war. In a speech in Philadelphia, Wilson counseled self-restraint while also drafting a strong diplomatic protest to Germany demanding the government take immediate steps to prevent such an incident from reoccurring. In tandem, in July 1915, he began to support military preparedness initiatives and asked Secretary of War Garrison and Secretary of the Navy Daniels for recommendations to increase spending in their departments. In October, the president approved Daniel's proposal for $500 million investment in the Navy, including 6 new battleships, alongside Garrison's recommendations for an army of 140,000 officers and men, supplemented by a 400,000-man reserve. In the midst of the debates over preparedness and German submarine attacks, Wilson had fallen in love with the 42-year-old widow Edith Bowling Gate, who was introduced to the president in March 1915 by his cousin Helen Woodrow Bones. Edith soon became a close political confidant, and despite her reservations about marrying a man who had been widowed less than a year earlier, the couple officially announced their engagement in early October and married on the 18th of December 1915. Around this time, Wilson was gearing up for his re-election campaign in the 1916 election. It would be a difficult campaign in many ways. While he was the incumbent and would ultimately be selected as the Democratic candidate unopposed in the summer of 1916, Wilson did face a lot of opposition within his party about the degree to which military spending was escalating to expand the Navy and military in case of war with Germany. He had a good degree of bipartisan support, though, with figures like Roosevelt being broadly in favor of Wilson's efforts to prepare America for war if the nation should be dragged into the European conflict. A controversial element of Wilson's presidency was his attitude towards the African-American population. Wilson was a liberal president in many respects and was a committed anti-imperialist when it came to global diplomacy, stances which make his views on the black community in America all the more unusual. There is no denying that Wilson was effectively racist in his approach to African Americans. He brought many people into his cabinet and lower down the administration who were committed supporters of segregation and the Jim Crow laws in the South, while he also introduced measures in the federal government which made it much more difficult for African Americans to acquire government jobs of any kind and for those already employed in federal posts to earn promotion. Towards the end of the 1910s, he introduced many elements of segregation into Washington, D.C. itself, while in an infamous event, The Birth of a Nation, a film which is widely credited with leading to a surge in membership of the Ku Klux Klan in the late 1910s and early 1920s, became the first film ever to be screened in the White House shortly after it was released in 1915. When major race riots and attacks occurred in the summer of 1919 in many cities across America, Wilson was in Europe. Although he did express some dismay at these events later on, he did so from a law and order perspective rather than declaiming attacks on black Americans. In any event, when informed in Paris of what was happening back in the US, he made no effort to take executive action to end the violence against African Americans during the Red Summer of 1919. Wilson's racial views are unquestionably a black spot on his legacy. In March 1916, Wilson was forced to turn his attention back to Mexico, where one of the revolutionary generals, Pancho Villa, had risen up against the government. A populist with a socialist platform, Villa had been at the height of his power in 1914 and 1915. In the spring of 1916, he attempted to draw the United States into the war by crossing the border into New Mexico and raiding the American garrison at the town of Columbus. After a fight which claimed the lives of 15 Americans and 67 Mexicans, on the 15th of March, Wilson sent a force of 4,000 men under General John Pershing to pursue Villa into Mexico. Pershing's forces succeeded in dispersing Villa's men, but the official Mexican government subsequently protested the presence of an American army deep inside Mexico. Clashes between Pershing's men and Mexican government troops led both sides to appoint a joint commission, which eventually provided for the withdrawal of American troops in February 1917. It was all an indication of how the Mexican Revolution of the 1910s presented an unstable situation across the southern border during Wilson's time as president. Wilson's desire to avoid outright war with Mexico was in part due to his recognition that American military resources might be required to deal with Germany. On the 24th of March, a German torpedo struck the SS Sussex, a British ship flying the French flag. Though the vessel did not sink, more than 80 people were killed and wounded, and of the 75 Americans on board, 4 were injured. Although there had been further German attacks on neutral shipping since the Lusitania, which had claimed American lives, under the influence of his wife, Edith, Colonel House and Secretary of State Lansing, on the 18th of April, Wilson issued an ultimatum to Germany threatening to break off diplomatic relations unless the Germans stopped their attacks. In response, the Germans agreed to stop submarine attacks without warning and apologized for the Sussex incident, sealing a diplomatic triumph for Wilson, which kept the United States out of the war for the time being. By September, Wilson worked alongside progressive Democrats in Congress to enact legislation regulating child labor, increasing income tax, and providing an 8-hour workday for railroad workers. Wilson's action over the 8-hour workday won him the support of the unions and socialists, and the Republican shift towards conservatism allowed him to pick up many former progressives. Despite this, the election was close, and on election day, Wilson's challenger, the Republican candidate Charles Evan Hughes, achieved substantial wins in the Northeast and Midwest, leading the New York Times to call the election for the Republican. It was only by winning Ohio and almost sweeping the western states that Wilson was re-elected with 277 electoral votes to Hughes' 254 in one of the narrower election victories in American history. Wilson had hoped to build on his domestic achievements, but his second term was almost entirely devoted to foreign and military affairs. In the winter of 1916 into early 1917, Wilson sent a peace initiative to the belligerents in Europe and in a speech to the Senate in January 1917 spoke of a peace without victory, one that would be acceptable to both sides given that the British, French and Germans had been mired in inconclusive trench warfare in northern France now for 2.5 years. However, the Germans had already decided to restart unrestricted submarine warfare in the Atlantic, hoping that German armies would have enough time to defeat the Allies in Europe before the United States could mobilize. The German Foreign Minister, Arthur Zimmermann, had also sent a telegram to the Mexican government seeking a military alliance and promising Mexico the recovery of Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona, which the United States had conquered from Mexico in the late 1840s. On the 31st of January, Wilson received notice from the German ambassador that unrestricted submarine warfare would begin the following day. The president responded by breaking off diplomatic relations with Germany and arming American merchant ships. On the 28th of February, the so-called Zimmermann Telegraph was made public, strengthening the calls for war. On the 4th of March, 1917, Woodrow Wilson was inaugurated to a second term as the drumbeat of war grew ever louder. Though he desperately sought an alternative for war, Wilson's cabinet was unanimously in favor of intervention given recent German actions, and the president authorized initiatives to increase the size of the standing army. In a fateful speech to Congress on the 2nd of April, Wilson sought authorization to go to war with Germany, declaring that the world must be made safe for democracy. Congressional authorization was granted on the 6th, at which time the United States entered the First World War by declaring war on Germany. Wilson quickly set out to mobilize the nation's resources for war. Over the course of the war, Treasury Secretary McAdoo would raise more than $15 billion in bonds known as Liberty Loans, while inheritance and income taxes were increased to finance military spending. On the 28th of April, Congress approved a draft bill which would conscript almost 3 million men into the army over the remainder of the war. Despite French and British pleas for American boots on the ground on the Western Front in France, it would take considerable time to train and equip large numbers of American troops. In the meantime, in May 1917, Wilson appointed General Pershing to command the American Expeditionary Force to Europe. When he arrived in June, Pershing wanted to ensure that his men remained broadly independent of British and French commanders. In order to protect the men from submarine attacks as they crossed the Atlantic, Wilson authorized convoys of American and British destroyers to protect merchant ships carrying men and supplies across the ocean. Through the new U.S. Shipping Board, a shipbuilding program was commenced, while in order to ensure that the Army and its allies were adequately supplied with food, he established a food administration agency run by the businessman and future Republican president Herbert Hoover to increase food production and limit waste. The president did not neglect assistance to other allies, and soon after entering the war, authorized a $325 million loan to Russia, which had suffered enormous reverses against the Germans on the Eastern Front in 1916 and 1917. Yet, this attempt to keep Russia in the war failed following the rise to power of the communist Bolsheviks in Russia in the October Revolution of late 1917 and their subsequent negotiation of peace terms with the Germans. As Wilson spoke of the war in terms of defending democratic rights, he became more receptive to women's suffrage campaigners. While many European and American nations had drifted gradually towards democracy in the 18th and 19th centuries, there were still many restrictions on who could or could not vote. Whilst most adult males were eventually given the right to do so, in the early 20th century, women still did not have the franchise in most countries, though there were extensive campaigns to achieve such in England, America, and elsewhere. In January 1918, Wilson decided to support an effort in Congress to adopt a constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote. Over the next year and a half, he continued to lobby Congress, especially the Senate, on the issue, and in the middle of 1919, the measure passed in both houses. A year later, the 19th Amendment was ratified by the states, giving women the right to vote. In late 1917, the impasse still had not been broken in Europe. Although British forces were successful in the Middle East fighting against the Ottoman Empire, this was a sideshow compared to the European theater, where Russia's collapse meant the Allies could only win the war on the Western Front, which remained stalemated. Although Wilson expanded America's role in the war by declaring war against Germany's ally, the Empire of Austria-Hungary, he continued to believe in peace without victory as the most effective means to maintain global peace after the war. To this end, on the 8th of January 1918, he delivered a speech to Congress in which he set out what he termed his 14 points, a series of objectives for America's war aims and how the world order should be structured in the aftermath of the conflict. These included opening peace talks straight away and, in the aftermath of the war, establishing things such as the freedom of the seas, armament reductions, and autonomy for national minorities within the Austro-Hungarian and Ottoman empires, as well as the creation of an independent Poland, a country which had been dismantled by Prussia, Russia, and Austria back in the late 18th century. Finally, he called for, quote, a general association of nations to protect the independence and integrity of great and small nations in the aftermath of the war. Following Russia's withdrawal from the war in the spring of 1918, Germany was able to turn its attention to the Western Front, and on the 21st of March, General Erich Ludendorff launched a spring offensive that broke the stalemate on the Western Front, making significant territorial gains not seen since the early days of the war. But the German breakthrough was short-lived. By May 1918, more than 1 million American troops were in France, and by July, 10,000 American troops were arriving every day, tilting the numerical balance back in favor of the British, French, and Americans. This enabled the Allies to mount a counteroffensive, and in the early autumn of 1918, 200 square miles of territory were recovered within the space of 6 weeks. The war planners believed that they could cross the Rhine into Germany the following spring, but this would not prove necessary. In Germany, domestic unrest was growing at food shortages, hyperinflation, and the perception that the war was doomed with so many American troops arriving to France. In early November 1918, mutinies broke out within the military and navy, and on the 9th of November, the German leader, Kaiser Wilhelm II, abdicated the throne. 2 days later, on the 11th of November 1918, an armistice was agreed between the Allied powers of Britain, France, and the United States, and Germany, providing for immediate German disarmament. Wilson had helped the Allies win the war, but there would be many disagreements among the victors when it came to making peace. Wilson decided to lead the American delegation in person at the peace talks which were held in Paris and Versailles through much of 1919. Wilson arrived in France on the 13th of December 1918. During preparations for the conference, he visited England and Italy, where he was the first American president to meet the Pope. The conference opened on the 18th of January 1919, and Wilson was appointed chair of the League of Nations Commission, a committee set up to establish the League of Nations, the new international organization Wilson had championed the creation of as a way of mediating disputes between nations going forward in the hope of avoiding conflicts like the First World War from happening again. Wilson had already produced 2 earlier drafts for a covenant of the organization, and a 3rd was produced jointly by the president and the 2 representatives of the British Empire, General Jan Smuts and Lord Robert Cecil. A Japanese effort to introduce a clause upholding racial equality was rejected by the British, while Wilson rejected a French plan to give the League an army to enforce its rulings. On the 13th of February, the draft covenant was agreed. largely reflecting Wilson's initial proposals, including the guarantee of independence and territorial integrity, the right of the League to be involved in wars anywhere in the world, a permanent court of international justice, and authority to apply economic sanctions and recommend military force. After presenting the draft covenant to the full conference on the 14th of February, Wilson returned to the United States for 2 weeks to sign bills passed by Congress before it closed its session. Wilson attempted to rally support for the League by meeting members of Congress privately in early March, but the proposals were attacked by Senator Henry Cabot Lodge for undermining the Monroe Doctrine, a long-standing American foreign policy position that Europeans should not be involved in the American continent, and vice versa. Soon after Wilson's return to France on the 13th of March, Wilson joined the leaders of Britain, France, and Italy in the Council of Four. This group would meet 148 times over the next 3 months and shaped most of the agreements in the peace conference. Wilson clashed with French Prime Minister Georges Clemenceau's demands for Germany to give up the Rhineland and the coal-rich Saarland to guarantee French security. On the issue of the size of reparations Germany was expected to pay, Wilson proposed a modest sum of some $30 million, while Clemenceau and his British counterpart David Lloyd George advocated much larger sums. The battle lines were clear. Lloyd George and Clemenceau wanted to punish the Germans and impose a triumphalist peace settlement, whereas Wilson wanted to show some mercy towards the defeated nations. In early April, Wilson fell ill with influenza, but returned to meetings of the Council after a 5-day break. Back at the League Commission, Wilson secured an exemption for the Monroe Doctrine, which he hoped would appease his domestic critics. On the key issues among the Big Four, Wilson proposed a commission to determine reparations to meet after the treaty was signed, and suggested that France administer the Saarland for 15 years before holding a referendum over sovereignty. Clemenceau also agreed to Wilson's compromise for a demilitarized Rhineland backed by Britain and American military guarantees. Wilson stood firm against Italian territorial claims in the Adriatic, which prompted the Italian delegation to withdraw on the 24th of April. The following day, in his desire to ensure Japanese support for the League, Wilson backed Japanese claims over the Shandong Peninsula in China, causing the Chinese delegation to leave. On the 28th, the final version of the League Covenant was agreed, incorporating Wilson's amendments. With this, the League of Nations would come into being in January 1920, but whether Wilson could ensure American membership at home remained a matter of debate. On the 7th of May, the preliminary peace terms were proposed to the German delegation, which arrived in Paris to receive them. On the 29th of May, the Germans argued the victors had gone back on their promises of a just peace. Despite their objections, on the 28th of June, the Treaty of Versailles was signed in the Hall of Mirrors at the Palace of Versailles. In it were laid the seeds of the Second World War. Wilson and the American delegation left Paris that evening and arrived home on the 8th of July. There, he immediately had a new battle to obtain a 2/3 majority in the Senate in favor of American membership of the League of Nations. The Republicans had regained majorities in the House and Senate, where Henry Cabot Lodge served as chair of the Foreign Relations Committee. On the 10th of July, the President presented the treaty to the Senate and made a plea for Americans' duty to the world. The Senate was split into around 40 supporters of the treaty, a similar number who largely endorsed the treaty but had reservations about its terms, and about a dozen irreconcilables who opposed joining the League of Nations under any terms. Although Wilson sympathized with some reservations, such as that over the cession of Shandong to Japan, he did not consider it feasible to renegotiate the treaty and adopted an uncompromising approach. At the beginning of September, he embarked on a three-week speaking tour to promote the League to the public, issuing the emotional plea that without the League to preserve peace in the future, the sacrifice of American servicemen during the war would have been in vain. Wilson's intensive speaking schedule had a significant impact on his health, and on the 26th of September, he was forced to cancel the tour and return to Washington. A week later, on the 2nd of October, he suffered a serious stroke which paralyzed his left arm and leg. Almost immediately after the stroke, Edith Wilson shielded her husband from view and resisted calls for his resignation while issuing optimistic statements about his prospects for recovery. Vice President Thomas Marshall, who had been largely anonymous in Wilson's administration, refused the calls from congressional Democrats to take over as president. By November, the president was gradually recovering and remained defiant. And when Lodge and the Republican senators proposed a set of 14 reservations, Wilson asserted that they would nullify the treaty. On the 19th of November, Lodge's reservations were rejected 55-39, while the treaty without reservations was voted down 53-38. In early 1920, moderate Democratic senators sought a compromise despite Wilson's defiance, and when the Senate voted on Lodge's reservations again on the 19th of March, a majority of Democratic senators voted in favor, but the 49-35 vote in favor did not reach the two-thirds threshold. In the end, the United States would neither ratify the European peace treaties nor join the League of Nations. It was a major defeat for Wilson's hopes of a new world order after the First World War. Defeat over the League was a bitter blow to Wilson, and his mental and physical condition prevented him from achieving much during his final year of office. By mid-April, he resumed cabinet meetings but provided little guidance on policy. Wilson had always given his cabinet secretaries autonomy over their departments, and the business of the administration largely carried on as usual. After the Republican majorities in Congress passed resolutions declaring the end of the war without a peace treaty, Wilson vetoed them at the end of May. He still hoped to take the fight to the Republicans over the League and aspired to run for a third term in the 1920 election, a delusion that his associates prevented from materializing with great difficulty. The eventual Democratic nominee, Governor James Cox of Ohio, fought a campaign promoting the League, but was defeated heavily by Republican Warren Harding, while Republicans won large majorities in both houses of Congress. On the 10th of December 1920, Wilson received the 1919 Nobel Peace Prize for his role in founding the League of Nations, which provided little consolation for American non-ratification. Having been an invalid for a year and a half, Wilson left the presidency on the 4th of March 1921. Soon after leaving office, Wilson opened a legal practice with Bainbridge Colby, who had served as his Secretary of State from 1920 until the end of his term. After refusing to take a number of high-profile cases on ethical grounds, the partnership was ended in December 1922. When Wilson turned his attention to writing, his efforts were also mostly unsuccessful. By the end of 1922, Wilson was honored by the establishment of the Woodrow Wilson Foundation, an initiative spearheaded by Franklin D. Roosevelt to honor individuals who promoted world peace. By 1923, Wilson was in his best health since his stroke, and he attended the funeral of his successor, President Harding, who died of cardiac arrest on the 2nd of August 1923. He was planning a run for the presidency and had drafted a speech accepting the Democratic nomination and a third inaugural address, but late in the morning of the 3rd of February 1924, Woodrow Wilson died at the age of 67. He was buried in the Washington National Cathedral, becoming the only president to be buried in the Capitol. In the years that followed the Treaty of Versailles, the punitive terms imposed on Germany became one of the reasons for the rise of the Nazis in Europe and the drift towards the Second World War, while the League of Nations proved ineffective without American participation. We cannot know how things might have turned out had Wilson's vision been fully realized, but perhaps history would have been different if a more lenient peace had been agreed at Versailles in 1919 and the United States had joined the League of Nations. Woodrow Wilson leaves behind a legacy as one of the most influential and controversial presidents of the United States. An academic for most of his life, Wilson was an insightful political scientist whose educational reforms helped to maintain Princeton University's reputation as one of the leading higher education institutions in the country. Although he was a late convert to the progressive cause, he secured a host of significant legislative victories during his short stint as governor of New Jersey, which enabled him to win the presidential election less than 2 years after holding elected office for the first time. As president, he enacted an ambitious legislative program, including the creation of the Federal Reserve System, the introduction of an income tax, and improved antitrust laws. However, his ambivalent attitude towards race cost him the support of the African Americans who backed him in 1912. For better and for worse, Wilson's greatest legacy is in foreign policy, and despite his efforts to keep the United States out of the war, Wilson was the man who took the country into the First World War and mobilized the nation's resources to ensure Allied victory. He played a key role in the Paris Peace Conference and was the founder of the League of Nations. Wilson's failure to secure ratification of the Treaty of Versailles and membership of the League undermined the organization as it struggled to respond to Japanese, Italian, and German militarism in the 1930s. The debilitating stroke he suffered in late 1919, in the midst of the greatest political fight of his presidency, opened an unhappy final chapter in Wilson's life. What do you think of Woodrow Wilson? Should he be hailed as one of the most successful progressive presidents in American history? And was he right to have gone to war with Germany in 1917? Or could he have shown more restraint in order to achieve the sort of negotiated peace he desired? Please, let us know in the comments section. And in the meantime, thank you very much for watching.